Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I will be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses, and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. There are not too many people I've met that can include the words theoretical physics, quick service retail management, and forensic accounting in the first 5 years of their resume, but my guest today can. Much to his parents' horror, Declan Doyle dropped out of Trinity after 1 year and went full-time managing 10 quick service retail stores in Dublin city centre, going to college by night to get a business degree. Realising accountancy might be a good skill to have, he trained with Grant Sugrue as a forensic accountant before going into the facilities maintenance industry with Noonan Services Group. Soon after, he was involved in a management buyout. Possibly not the best time transaction, I think he would admit, but the company still managed to grow through the early years of the financial crisis with him in the role of CFO. The successful implementation of an ERP system was followed up by a large UK acquisition to bolster their position there. In 2017, it was time for their private equity partners to say goodbye as they found a new home with Bidvest PLC, a South African-headquartered services trading and distribution company. The transition from private equity to PLC ownership was easy. Then in 2019, the CEO retired from the business and Declan stepped into the role, where he remains today. The business has trebled in the last 6 years with revenues now north of 900 million euro, and they have a team of over 27,000 passionate and customer-focused people. He may never have received a theoretical physics degree from Trinity, but he does have an MBA from there. Declan, you're very welcome. I rattled through it. I bet you never thought your life would be consumed into that small a paragraph.
No, but you did a good job.
Right, to start with, can you tell me how someone goes from theoretical physics in Trinity College to managing 10 quick service retail stores in Dublin city centre and then to train as a forensic accountant all before the age of 25?
It's an interesting journey. I think for me, when I was studying in secondary school, for me, it was all about physics and maths. I absolutely loved it. Very big in sci-fi, still am today. And I had this dream to go and work in the European Space Agency, and I was very single-minded about it, to the point where I only put theoretical physics and maths on the CAO form. Luckily, I got it. And I started my first year in Trinity, and it wasn't everything I expected. And at the exact same time, I started working in a quick service retailer at the bottom of Grafton Street. I absolutely loved it. And there was an opportunity at the end of the first year to work as an assistant manager in the store and earn an extra pound an hour. And I thought, I'll grab that for the summer. And at the end of that summer, the owner came to me and said, look, would you take your own store? And I decided, you know what, the theoretical physics wasn't right for me. I was really loving working in the retail, working with colleagues, customers coming in. I loved the buzz of changing things around in the store, trying to boost the sales. I mean, I was out selling Easter eggs on Grafton Street and getting chased away by the council for doing it. But it was just great fun. And I decided I'd take a year out and see where it went. A year became two, became three as I got more stores, etc. And then I decided I wanted to do it on my own. But the banks didn't really want to lend money, and certainly I didn't have any landlords that wanted to sign a lease with a 19, 20 year old kid. So I decided I had to go back and get a qualification by night, which I did. The thing my father always wanted me to do was accountancy, so it was the last thing on my list. But I decided to do it, and I've never really looked back. And I think for me, I've always been a reluctant accountant. I find most accountants will tell you that. But for me, it's the language of business. Mm-hmm. And I've always loved numbers. That's the whole piece with maths and physics. But those numbers to really explain how a business works really, really fascinated me. So once I stepped into that accountancy world, I think there was really no way back.
But I suppose with the training and working with Grant Sugrue, by the sounds of it, though, it was only ever going to be a stepping stone. Your eye was always to get into industry or entrepreneur or something. It was a skill set to have.
Absolutely. I mean, that to me, accountancy unlocks the door to any industry. And I you know, when I was finishing up with Grant Tuger, I really wanted to go back into retail. And this opportunity that came up with Noonan Services, I never forget the recruiter ringing me and he said, I've got a great opportunity for you. And I said, well, actually, I've just been made an offer by this company called Noonan Services. And he said, that is such a dull industry. I can get you a role in a much sexier industry. And I think my mind was made up when I heard that. I thought, no. And I tell you, it's one of these industries that's very under the radar, but has been incredibly exciting. And actually, it is not too dissimilar to retail. So I love it.
The moving on then, obviously, the change, operating under the private equity banner first and then under a bid vest. Yeah, as you look back, what's been the big differences, you know, good and bad? Because oftentimes people just say, oh, this is bad. But what was the benefits of private equity versus PLC, and what were the drawbacks of PE versus PLC?
Well, look, I mean, you know, timing's an important factor here as well. I mean, we got PE backing, you know, the deal completed the weekend of the bank guarantee, right? So, you know, you're taking 50 million of debt onto the balance sheet for the first time ever. And all the banks were quite concerned that that was a 28-year-old newbie CFO in control of that, right? So it was, there were challenging times. But I remember reading the investment paper that our PE partners prepared when investing in us. And they used the term, we want to professionalise the business. And I remember at the time being quite insulted by the term. but we went through a journey over the next 9 or 10 years, which was a very long journey for PE and, you know, true a big recession. But they stuck with us and they backed us. And in fact, they gave us follow-on capital to do deals. And they really understood and backed the management team. They didn't always understand the industry we played in. Mm-hmm. And if I'm honest, it took quite a number of years for the PE guys to wrap their heads around the industry. But they were extremely supportive. I would say extremely challenging, very, very focused on the numbers. You're always got exit in mind. You start talking about it at the first board meeting and you talk about it every meeting to the last board meeting. So that's a firm focus. And I think as a result, we tended to be more short-term thinkers than we are today. But we invested in the business through acquisitions, new systems. You know, we brought in some senior management into the business that had different experience that enabled us to expand our service offering, be more innovative in our solution design for our clients. So they did in the end bring that professionalism. Mm-hmm. What I'm really proud about is actually it was the same team that went in came out.
Right. Yeah.
So myself, John, and Fintan, we were the three that were there on day one, and we were there at the end of the journey. So I've nothing but praise for what that private equity business did for us. PLC, on the other hand, it's, you know, what's been the biggest positive change has been that long-term view. Mm. So we no longer think about exit. We're thinking very, very long time horizons. And we've got an owner who, it's a conglomerate, but they do own businesses that deliver the services we deliver in other geographies. So they really understand our business. So when the day inevitably comes where you do lose a big contract and you explain the reason behind it, they get it. And it's okay, let's chalk it down, let's learn from it and let's move on. So we've had a great, I would say we got used to the PLC inside of a couple of months. It took us a few years with private equity, and that was about the industry knowledge. It's a PLC, so they're still focused on numbers, but not in the same way. It's mm-hmm. If this is the right thing to do for the business for the long run, then we will do it.
And do you think it helped, given that you are a numbers-based person when you were dealing with the PE, that you were kind of maybe not speaking exactly the same language, but it was a derivation of the same language, if you will?
Listen, there's no doubt about it. I think it's huge. I think it, well, we of all the people we had on our board over the years, most of them were accountants. One of them was also a physicist, actually, but very numbers-focused people. Interestingly, in the PLC, you'll find the same thing. I mean, most people in the PLC at a level will have accountancy or have had accounting somewhere in the background.
And within the PLC, then, given the fact that Bidvest have, as you said, same operations, is there much kind of you know, cross learnings going on and trying to pick out, you know, going down looking what they do and saying they do that really well, can we bring that back? And then in the same way going, lads, you know, you might try doing this in
Yeah, I mean, it's done very, very informally. I mean, Bidvest PLC is very informal. It's very decentralised. They look to back entrepreneurial management teams. But we do share. I had a team up here in Dublin and London last week from Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. So five people came up. They had a look at some retail environments, some healthcare environments. They looked at some of the innovation we're bringing, the dynamic cleaning, some of the robotics we're using. And similarly in London and looking at some of our sustainability solutions. So the guys come up and learn. Also take a look at how we structure ourselves. So, you know, whilst we're delivering the same service, how do we think about client relationship management? How do we think about our commercials, etc.? So we do that, but it's very conversational. Mm. So we're talking, we're out for dinner, chatting about it. What did we learn today? Mm. Bouncing the different structures and, you know, the guys will be sharing over dinner. We do it differently, we do it that way. And it really is for the local management teams then to take away what they think will work. Yeah. And I think that works beautifully because it's not imposing any one way, you know, across what are very, very different businesses in reality.
And you bring up an interesting point because I've asked a lot of people about, you know, culture in a can you, and like you might say to me, well, it's not really a global company because we operate ours locally, but the reality is it is a global company that you're looking at, and I'm not sure you can have a global culture. You can kind of have an ethos then is localized for each operation in each country that you operate in.
I 100% agree. I think what I would say to you is Bidvest transformed the culture in our business in a really soft way, really, really quickly, by having a very clear focus on people. So Bidvest start with, you know, we won't buy a business that we don't really get the management team, that we really don't like the management. And I've been through many acquisitions before and since, and I can tell you that is a clear difference. Mm. With private equity, we're looking at numbers on a spreadsheet and we're seeing how this is going to fit in and how it's going to impact the return model. Bidvest is a completely different in that respect. So much more people focused, which has been huge for hugely beneficial for our business. There's a bigger focus on having fun along the way, which I think is really, really positive. But you're right, you can't have that global culture. And I think for us as a business, I do think you need to aspire to have that umbrella culture for your brand. Mm. So we're Bidvest Noonan and we operate across the UK and Ireland. Mm. And we have different cultures within that business. You know, you don't simply have one. But for us, what's really, really important is, you know, we're a very results-focused business. So that is in our culture. Mm. If you come in, people know what it is they have to deliver. But we're really, really passionate about making sure that we care for the people that we work with. So no matter who you are in the organisation, think of your peers, think of your manager even as a person, think about those that work for you. And if you bring that caring culture and you demonstrate caring behaviours, we think it just makes it a better place to work.
The point you made there about the M&A transaction and with Bidvest being it being much more than just financial, and maybe private equity being very much by the numbers and things like that. It might sound like a silly question, but do you think the overlaying the culture thing results in a much better success rate in terms of total return when the business has done the deal than maybe just looking at the numbers going, okay, well, we made, you know, a return on invested capital of 18%. Aren't we great? Yeah, but you've left carnage behind you.
Yeah, look, I mean, ultimately... Listen, we've made mistakes in some of our M&A under Bidvest, and I'm talking about not the acquisition itself, because all of them have stacked up extremely well. But when you're dealing with that level of change for people and you're changing brands and you're changing ways of working, I think there's lots we can learn and how we can do it better. What is good, I think, in the PLC and the Bidvest culture will be we actually stop and we think about that and we care about that and we try and learn from that. I think in the PE world, we would have been more focused on, you know, what is the outcome from this.
And when you went into the, when, you know, if you're catching my back to the MBO bit and the private equity, right? Did you have on that transformation of the business, did you have in your own mind what success would look like and what the next stage would be and the outcome would be and how different is that to what has actually transpired?
So it's very interesting. So we had a view and the private equity had a view and, you know, board meeting one, we realised we were very different, right? Where we ended up was closer to our view, but it's not where we spent the first couple of years. So, look, we did have a view. Listen, we slammed into the deepest recession. We had customers looking for substantial reductions in service and we had to stand by our customers and re-engineer solutions and keep the show on the road. And, I mean, we did grow the business hugely, but I think most businesses' plans went out out the window in September 2008. What I'd say is where we ended up at the end of the journey in 17 was beyond where we'd originally expected. We had diversified the service offering. We were a proper TFM provider in Ireland, which was the goal, and it was fantastic to achieve that. But actually the presence in the UK and the size and scale of the opportunity there was something that we hadn't planned to do in that original plan. But actually it made us a very attractive proposition for a global player like Bidvest, who, you know, we obviously have the market leadership in Ireland. We don't take it for granted, but we've had it for a very, very long time. You know, the UK, we have a platform now that, you know, we're top five, which is huge in the market. I mean, the FM market in the UK is £80 billion. Mm. I mean, it's a big market.
Big market. You know, BVN is the largest, and possibly one of the largest private sector employers in Ireland. And like, when you look at the breadth and the depth of the service offering that you got, it's probably pretty much unmatched. Right? You said you're kind of the leaders in space. But what headaches has that expansion brought to you in terms of staffing and just structures and processes and things like that?
Well, look, I think the irony is, as we've got the scale into the business, some of those things have become easier. And I think scale matters in this industry. So we have specialists in various different functions, whether that be just, you know, somebody looking after, on the IT side, just somebody dedicated to cloud, or on the HR side, just somebody dedicated to talent acquisition. And as you get bigger, you get bigger teams, more experienced teams. You get fine-tune your processes, fine-tune your systems. Just be relentless in making sure you're the best at what you do in that. And actually, that means when we're competing with smaller players in the market who don't have those specialisms and can't afford that type of overhead. So a lot of that has been really, really positive for us. And in this current environment, you know, things are difficult out there. You've got high cost of living increases. You've got super low unemployment in the UK and Ireland. It makes recruitment in our space very difficult. Mm-hmm. But if we do it better than our competitors and we do it better than some adjacent industries, then we can stay ahead. And that's been the evidence. And we've won a lot of business over the last year from competitors who are failing to deliver the service because of those challenges. Our scale and our specialisms within that scale have helped us.
You mentioned the idea of staff and things like that. Where are you on the you know, hiring talent from outside or developing from within?
Oh, listen, you've got to bring in a mix, but you know, ideally you bring them in at a kind of a middle level and develop from there. I think some of the we have hugely experienced people right across the business in Ireland. I would say almost everybody in our top 50 people in Ireland all come through internal promotions. I mean, the Irish team is just really experienced. They know exactly what each other's strengths and weaknesses are. They play as a team. It's absolutely fantastic. In the UK, because we've gone through this, you know, the staggering growth. I mean, we've gone, I always tell the story that, you know, we've been in the UK 20 years. We started out with 10 million of business. Over the first 10 years, we took it from 10 million to 5 million, right? I mean, it was fantastic stuff. But we've taken it from 5 million to 500 million over the last 10 years. And so we've had to bring in a lot of management. So we're not, we've hugely experienced people, but we don't have experience of playing together. So that's coming. So I think you got to have a mix, but my preference always is have the majority are homegrown, you know. Yeah,
and they're kind of clued in. They get how the place works.
They get how the place works. Yeah. That's it.
The other thing I think that's interesting and it'd be great to get your insight on it is, because you've come from both sides of it, is the organic versus acquired growth, right? You know, which do you find easier? Which do you find adds more value to the business, or is it possible to even tell?
Look, for me, the whole purpose of the acquisitions is actually to enhance the organic growth. So if you look at the acquisitions we would have done in Ireland in the early days, they were about service diversification. And I would say, you know, that job is done, and therefore the organic growth we are delivering in Ireland is fantastic, and that's our primary focus in Ireland now. And where the guys come to us and say, listen, we think we need to bundle this service in, we take a look at it, is this something we need to acquire, can we set up ourselves? We probably don't prefer to do that, but we'll look at that. But it's really about filling in, what do our customers really need? Have we got a gap in that, and how can the M&A help with that? In the UK, we've spent the last while filling out the geography. It's a big geography for us. We've now got 17,000 people up and down the length and breadth of GB. So that geographic footprint is there, which then allows you to go to the large nationwide customers and say, we have that geographic footprint. Here's the service offering in that geographic footprint. Can we talk? Yeah. And really in the UK, there's been a lot of consolidation, a lot of failure with the larger players. And we're a fresh voice. Even though we're there 20 years, we're a fresh voice at the table.
The other thing that I often talk to people with big customer focus or facing businesses, right? I always find it's interesting. Customers are great at telling you what's wrong with a product, right? But not necessarily great at telling you what the solution is on this one. So how do you approach that kind of interaction with customers in terms of the service? Because you said service is like really the most important thing.
Service. And look, I think it's also relationship management. I mean, we in a service industry, no matter what the service you're delivering, we deliver an accountancy or tax services, ultimately you're reliant on the people that are delivering the service, and things can go wrong when people are involved. So I think our real focus is ensuring we've got really solid, open relationships with our customers. So we have our operational teams who are very focused on delivering that service, meet the customers' needs, trying to anticipate the customers' needs and solve those. But we also separately spend a lot of time, you know, surveying our customers, having independent relationship management, health checks, to make sure that what we're doing is meeting with their needs. And we see it as our role. You know, we clients come to us because, listen, this is not core to our business. You guys need to do it. And so we bring solutions to clients. We try to anticipate the problems. Not every client is going to want to go with all of that. But I see it as our role to actually solve those problems if a client has one. It's not always easy. But I think where the relationship is really good, you can have that more difficult conversation if it's something that can't perhaps be solved.
The other thing, I suppose, given the growth that you've seen both, you know, in pure revenue and in customer numbers and geography and things like that, you know, as you get bigger, does the level of kind of a continuity of service fall, or is that something that you just got to make sure that it doesn't matter how big, you know, if it's this client with you know, two establishments, or this client with 100 establishments, the service level is the same?
Listen, holding on to the customers we have, I mean, that's the best way to grow your business. I mean, it's, and listen, I'm not sure we've always understood that, but we understand it now. And I think, again, we have really impressive retention rates because we're very, very focused on our customers. I think we all have that experience where, you know, whether it's a telco or, you know, a broadband provider or, you know, TV, giving you these introductory rates for the new customer, and you're thinking, hey, I'm here. I'm here years. What about me? You know, we don't want, you know, a massive part of our growth opportunity is growing with the customer. What more can we do for the customer?
Share of wallet.
Yeah. But for us, and we used to use share of wallet internally, service diversification, service density, cross-selling. We don't use anything like that now. Right. What we do as a business is we say, look, grow with your customer. Show us that growth with your customer. We don't even get into how many services or anything like that. Can we be doing more for that customer? And what's been great is empowering the guys in the field to do that and to know which is the right service for that client in that moment.
Yeah. When you look at the success to date, you know, how much of it is due to luck? How much is hard work?
Look, there's always an element of luck, in my view. But I think you have to put in the hard work to take advantage of that, if you know what I mean.
And you know, when you look back, what mistake do you think you learned the most from, and how did you apply it to the business?
That's a really good question. I mean, we make lots of mistakes, you know, and they're all learning opportunities. I think there's been times when we're going through a big change program, particularly on an acquisition, and we've gotten very, very focused on timelines, system switchovers, roll out of new processes, training, etc., and not taking account that the change journey for everyone on the other side of this is very different, and people, you know, some people really embrace that change and want to just pick it up and run with it, and other people, we need to hold the hand more and take our time and understand what's really going on for them. And I think the biggest mistake was, you know, on one or two integrations where we didn't take that time. And that's something we take forward into our next integration.
As you look back at your career, to what extent is fear of failure being a big driving force?
I really haven't had that fear of failure. I mean, what's been great about my time in the business is, you know, I've always just been part of this amazing team.
Yeah.
And we're in it together. And all the big decisions we talk about together, usually we have, you know, we're unanimous on that. And the odd time I have to make a decision. But actually, we've never had that fear because you know you've got this incredible bunch of people around you.
And a great business.
It's great business, a great brand. And, you know, that's been going a long time. And we're just privileged to be in the seat right now.
The other area I'm interested in talking about, and I can point to probably two areas that you've got up, but the approach to crisis management. Obviously, you know, MBO happens, you're in the middle of a global financial crisis, but nearer to home, or nearer to today, you had COVID. And both were probably massive crises for the business, you know, financially in one case, but also operationally in the second case.
COVID, I remember I remember being on a train from London to York, and I'd gotten informed by a reliable source that Leo Varadkar was going to come out on the steps of the White House and make an announcement, and I redesigned our org structure on the train from London to York, I got a call on this thing called Teams that we just launched that week, and I announced to the team, and I put a phone call into South Africa, and they called me back the next day and said, listen, we think you may have lost the plot because you're talking about keeping cash flow and keeping people safe and getting everybody back to work, and this is a flu. Within a couple of weeks, it was pretty clear what we were facing. And I got the last flight, it felt like the last flight out of the UK to Dublin that night. And I arrived back quite sick. I'd gotten COVID. I'd been in London, Manchester, York, Edinburgh, in the previous 14 days. I mean, it was I was bound to get it. So I started it off suffering. I remember doing the first couple of calls with the sweat rolling down my face, trying to keep everybody positive. And I remember actually choking up a little bit with a tear because I looked at the faces on the screen, and I knew we were heading into this with the best team we've ever had. And I knew whatever we needed to do, we were going to do it. So the way the business stood up, there was leaders just grew, sprung out of all kinds of places during that period. And it quite frankly, it was amazing. And I think the people on the front line were out there, you know, going into hospitals, you know, having to clean these particular ICU, etc. So we've got people in that, we've got people in retail, people in transport, where we had to keep transport going. And those frontline people went out and were taken. We didn't know at those early days what kind of risk was being taken. So we owed it to them as a management team to keep the show on the road. We'd at one stage we had 5,000 people on furlough in the UK, and we'd 1,000 vacancies in healthcare in Ireland, right? So you had all of this going on and not knowing, listen, these furlough schemes, this one's going to end in 2 weeks' time. What do we do? How do we, etc. So there was a lot to navigate. But again, It was probably the time that I'm most proud of in the business, not for anything I did, but just for the amazing way everyone came together and did what needed to be done.
It's interesting, and I think in time people will look back at it, and you know, the ironically, the benefits that your company will have from that in terms of the people that stepped up, the skill set and things like that. I remember interviewing Gary McGann, and he referred to a previous CEO they worked for in Grand Met, and he said, you know, the best managers, he said, what you've got to remember is, you know, the best managers are from companies that have gone to war. They've never gone. And that was a war of a different nature. But it's that idea of being in the trenches, not knowing what tomorrow comes. You know, anybody can manage a company when it's on a nice glide path and everything is wonderful. But you're real in the heat of battle. That's when your real lieutenants and sergeants stand up.
Oh, it was just incredible. And you're right. I mean, I see the people that emerged from the shadows then are in very senior roles today. You know, and that is exciting. I think. Probably on the downside from the COVID, and particularly in the management support roles, I think this whole debate around hybrid working and home working and all of the rest. I think, you know, when you look at those faces on the screen, you know they've worked together. You know they know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and they know what needs to be done. That's fantastic. But as things change and new people come in and all the rest, trying to build that type of team dynamic in a virtual way is just it's just not possible. Just not possible.
Switching, I suppose, in terms of the owners and but also maybe the board and the investors. You know, how important is it for your capital investors, be it a PLC or private equity, to be aligned with you and your goals for the business when you're going through that?
For me personally, 100%. It's critical. I mean, I'd hate to imagine how that could have been different. I mean, the guys were extremely supportive because of the way COVID broke out. In particular, we were ahead on the curve. Ireland was slightly ahead in terms of the UK, so we had learnings there that we could transport into the UK, and equally we'd learnings that we could then transport into and share with South Africa. So that was really, really important. But we had nothing but support. I mean, I remember, you know, speaking to the guys in early days, you're thinking about, you know, we have management pay cuts, we put this on hold, we put that on hold. And what I got from my boss was, Let's take it slow. Let's see how this goes. Let's keep talking, you know. And there's just a very calm, long term approach in Bidvest. It's like, okay, this we may not have seen this particular crisis before, but we've seen other crises. So that was huge. And I have to say, ourselves and Bidvest and my boss Alan, I mean, we just do talk the same language, and I think that really, really helps. We're both direct, so we always know where we stand, and we just are very, very aligned on the core important things. And I think that, particularly we're on opposite sides of the planet, I think that that's critical. If that wasn't there, I just don't think it would work.
What have you learned from other executives or other companies that you've because you obviously deal with a lot and things like that?
Well, listen, we'll beg, borrow and steal wherever we can. I mean, we're extremely privileged. I mean, last week I was in the north of England walking a car production line, you know, from start to finish. You could be, you know, in a manufacturing plant that's just done the latest drug or inside hospital environments. And you're in there, you're there to meet the team, see how everything's happening. But you've always got an eye there to see, listen, what can we learn here, you know, and always having a quick glance at the notice board and going, oh, that's an interesting initiative they have there. But we're not afraid to reach out to our clients and try to do that. So, you know, if we were doing a particular initiative on the people front, we our chief people and culture officer could reach out to people in similar roles in our client organisations and seek to learn from that. So I think that's been hugely beneficial. I think for me, my I've been very, very lucky with who I've worked with in the past. John O'Donoghue, our former CEO, I would meet with, you know, probably once a quarter, get his counsel quite a lot. Some of the people that I worked with in private equity would be the same. And there's people I've met through the various corporate finance and accounting firms through all these. I mean, we've done 18 acquisitions in my time here. You know, you get a network there that when you need something, you can reach out.
There's somebody there
to help, and you have to have that. But my own team is the first place I go to for counsel. Mm. You know, it really is.
The given, I suppose, your eclectic start to your career in terms of the both college and everything else, and there'd be a lot of kids out there just have to start university and maybe they thought they were in the course that they always wanted. But what advice would you give to young people today?
Just go with your heart. Go with what you think is going to make you happy. I think, and you can reinvent your career in your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, right, your 60s. There is no wrong time to jump horses. So I would say, you know, be patient and give it a little bit of time to make sure you're making the right decision. But you can change your mind as many times as you want, and just make sure that what you're doing, you're happy, you want to get up out of bed, go in and enjoy your day. And I think that's what it's got to be about. The day I stop enjoying it is the day I stop.
Very good. Now, the final question. Okay. The black book opens up, as you know, the tradition. I've told you what it is. Oh, I don't know what your question is, but here we go. Oh, well, this is going to be interesting, right? This is going to be interesting. In a nutshell, where is your company's single biggest untapped opportunity?
I would say there is more services we can provide to our existing customers. And I think, you know, we've been very under the radar for a very long time. And as a result, most customers know us for the services we provide them. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, there are customers who say to us, I didn't know you did cleaning. It blows my mind. So, you know, whilst we're constantly growing that service offering, I think we could double our business if we were delivering the fullest service offering to every customer that we have today. So I think there is a big opportunity there. It's been a very, you know, slow piece over the last 10, 15 years. But I think the more customers know we can do, the more they trust us. We do what we say. We design solutions that work. They trust us more with our services. And I just think perhaps we could step up our game on that. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Declan Doyle. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.